This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, the future of drop boxes in Wisconsin. We break down the state Supreme Court ruling and how will it impact elections going forward. Plus, the GOP field of candidates running for governor narrows, why Kevin Nicholson suspended his campaign. And Milwaukee may be the last option to host the Republican National Convention. We'll explain why. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for July 8th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
So, J.R., the big Supreme Court decision this week, there was multiple that we're going to go through throughout the show. But let's first start with the future of absentee ballot drop boxes. Just this morning, the High Court ruled that drop boxes are illegal in Wisconsin. We're talking about the ones not at the local clerk's office, the ones that are placed at the fire stations and throughout communities. I believe Dane County, Milwaukee County really had multiple of these locations. So unmanned drop boxes are no longer be able to be used in future elections. Here are some of the justices weighing in on this ruling. Let's bring up the full screen from Justice Rebecca Bradley that says WEC's staff may have been trying to make voting easy as possible during the pandemic, but whatever their motivations, WEC must follow Wisconsin statutes. Justice Ann Bradley, in the dissent opinion, said it's seemingly taken the opportunity to make it harder to vote. We've heard this argument multiple times from many Democrats that taking away these drop boxes is going to create more barriers for people in voting. But ultimately, I think the key decision in here and big question mark going forward is that we don't know, whether or not, someone technically right now could still gather a bunch of ballots from other people and return it for them and put it in the mail. But an individual voter can only return their ballot in person at their local clerk's office or put it in the mail. So a lot of, up in the air, how we see this going forward.
So looking at the decision, I don't know how much of an impact it's going to have on the fall election because, remember, pre-spring of 2020, we didn't use drop boxes in Wisconsin. People voted mostly in person at the polls. The COVID-19 pandemic really got people turned on to absentee voting because of the ease of it, the convenience, and that they didn't have to go to a public site where other people were gathering and possibly get exposed to COVID. Life is kind of back to normal. I mean, numbers are down of cases. I don't know if we're going to see the same reliance on absentee voting this fall we saw in 2020. So, grand scheme of things, a big impact. Maybe it's more that people have this convenience, this option. They don't trust the mail, things they're on time, right? So this option of going to the drop box is no longer there. So they, that's why Democrats are unhappy. They're seeing this as taking away an option, a right from people. Republicans, they thought these weren't authorized by state law. So it's kind of like going back to like the way things were before. But, like you said, there's some unanswered questions. For example, who can mail a ballot? This is a big deal for people who have a disability because some of them cannot physically put the ballot in the mailbox at their home because they don't have that capability. It's not clear, because the court didn't address it, what the line is for who can mail a ballot. The court said we're not going to address that question in this decision. Now, in talking to Rick Esper, Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty, which brought this challenge to drop boxes, he said, look, we're not concerned about people with disabilities. What our concern is if you have a bunch of people gathering a bunch of ballots and then dropping in the mail, that's a concern. That's what they're going to watch for. Talking to Disability Rights Wisconsin, they feel like between this decision and federal law protections that they have, that people with disabilities should feel comfortable having somebody else put their ballot in the mail or helping them return the ballot. So they're comfortable with that right now. But you still could see more court action on that question going forward because it wasn't answered by the court.
Right. And I think bigger picture, too, this really kind of impacts a little bit smaller towns, smaller communities, rural Wisconsin, because maybe their clerk's office is really a far drive and maybe they had the convenience of, putting in a drop box at a local location, et cetera. This hasn't really changed anything because our last election, too, drop boxes were also not allowed to be used in the previous election. So not much change, but like you said, during the pandemic, a lot of people liked the option of absentee voting. We'll see where that trend goes. And Republicans, I think, are celebrating that they at least got you know, something from the high court today, even though there's still these lingering questions that someone can technically, which they have been really against, it's called ballot harvesting. You know, I could go around my neighborhood and say, all right, I'm coming by on Tuesday at 5 o'clock. I'll grab your ballot for you, and I'll just put it in the, drop it off at the post office, et cetera. So.
Now, these questions could all be answered with a legislative fix. However, a legislative fix would require the current apparatus of Republican lawmakers and Democratic Governor Tony Evers agreeing. They haven't been able to do that so far. Remember, there was a bill that would have allowed people to designate an agent to return a ballot for them. That was vetoed. There are other things in there Governor Evers was not a big fan of because there are no clean election bills this past cycle. They were all kind of omnibus bills, we call them, with lots and lots of provisions. But you could have a legislative fix that would address this issue. Who can mail it? How do you fill it out? If there's an agent for you, if you have a disability, all those could be answered. I don't think we're going to get that between now and November. Also, if we have a Republican in the East Wing come January, you will see this addressed along with a host of other things from Republicans. If it's still Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers, can they reach a compromise on anything, even a question like this? Who can mail a ballot? We'll see.
All right. Let's kind of move on to another decision that happened this morning. The Supreme Court also ruled that local health officials can unilaterally make own, I guess, health decisions when it comes to addressing a global pandemic, bigger things, where they don't have to go through the approval process, which they technically had to do beforehand.
So you can issue the order. For example, in this case, Dane County, Madison, is a shared public health officer. She issued a decision on COVID-19, an order, without getting the county board to sign off. The court said that's okay. That's allowed by state statutes. This is not state officials. This is local officials. They have a separate authority under state law that gives them this power to do that.
Let's move on to the next case that also happened a little bit earlier in this week. The high court also ruled 4-3 to uphold a lower court ruling that allows Crystal Kaiser to argue self-defense to justify the killing of a Kenosha man she said was abusing her and tried to traffic her. Now, Crystal Kaiser was 17 at the time when this all happened, and her lawyers have argued that there's a 2008 law that allows victims of trafficking to have an affirmative defense for any offense committed as a direct result of being trafficked. So, bigger picture here, JR, this really can have ripple effects across the nation for trafficking cases.
So, if you think about it, part of the law was created was that if you are trafficked, you are, you know, you're engaged in prostitution. You're not going to be charged for prostitution if you were trafficked. The court ruling is saying, look, this law doesn't define what those affirmative defenses are. This gives her the option to raise it at court. Now, if you read the court decision very closely, she still must raise evidence at the circuit court level to justify the defense. So it's not like she's guaranteed she can, you know, make this argument and the jury will hear it. She has to raise the evidence to prove, support her claim. They're also saying this is an affirmative defense to first-degree homicide, or it could be a mitigating one to first degree. But it is a big deal if you've been trafficked that you can raise this defense. It expands greatly. Some people I talk to, the number of crimes you can address with this protection from 2008.
Yeah, there's nearly 40 states that have passed laws that give trafficking victims at least some level of criminal immunity, and that's according to Legal Action of Wisconsin. So we could probably just see this being used a little bit more in courtrooms across the nation when it comes to this type of argument. Can't also miss another big shakeup in the governor's race here in Wisconsin. Kevin Nicholson suspended his campaign earlier this week, basically saying he didn't want to go towards the negative route. And so that was kind of the main purpose of why he decided to get out of the race. Here, we'll just pull a quote from him real quick. "The only path forward to our campaign is attacking other candidates in the race on the airwaves. And while our team has the capability of do that, it's not something he wanted to do, nor do we believe it would be good for the party to do so." So, you know, this kind of really shakes up the race a little bit. It really narrows it to, I would say, kind of a two-person race. Of course, State Rep Tim Rantham is still in the race, but we have the front runners now, Tim Michaels and Rebecca Clayfish, kind of going toe-to-toe. And just shortly after this announcement, we saw Rebecca Clayfish come out with an ad hitting Tim Michaels, specifically about gas prices. Let's take a listen.
"I'm Rebecca Clayfish, and I've put more than 200,000 miles on this old minivan. Thankfully, most of them came before Joe Biden and Tony Evers jacked up our gas prices. As your governor, I'll fight to cut taxes and stop liberal spending to lower costs for everyone. Tim Michaels pushed for years to raise our gas tax while getting rich from massive government contracts. Tim Michaels is out for himself. I'm Rebecca Clayfish, and I'm on your side."
So as you just heard from Clayfish, this was kind of the launching off point where it's like, all right, here we go. It seems like a two-person race. Let's start kind of taking jabs at each other. Tim Michaels was kind of tweeting about gas prices, took some hits at Clayfish. So now we're starting to see this as we are just about 4 weeks out from the primary election, which we expected to see at some point, JR, but now
so
it's happening.
Let's talk Michaels, or, sorry, Nicholson first.
Yeah.
In about 7 days and 12 hours, you must turn in your finance reports for the first half of the year. I'll bet you a soda that when Nicholson files his report, you're not going to see a whole lot of dollar signs in that report. So yes, he didn't want to go negative, but people I've talked to wondered, does he have the option to go negative? Because you look at the polls, the Marquette poll, which I love the poll for general elections, primaries we talked about, tough to for primaries, but still a good one to watch trends. He's at 10% in that poll. It really was kind of a two-person race already. Michael's campaign after the Clayfish ad came out gave me some of his own polling, showed him up by 9 points on Clayfish. Nicholson had 11 before he dropped out. Now, primary polling in general is unreliable, especially a month out from an election. Once you get closer, it's better to do. But even then, primary polling is difficult. So I want to offer that caveat. But my point is, Nicholson was already in third place, a distant third place. He didn't have the resources to go make a move going negative to get up to one or two. Now, this may curry him some favor with the grassroots because he dropped out rather than going negative. Scott Walker back in 2006, he was running for governor against Mark Green, the GOP nomination. Green was the kind of establishment favorite for that nomination back then. Walker, and I think it was end of March, said, I'm gonna drop out. I could win the primary, but I wouldn't have enough resources to win the general election. That won him a bunch of chips with the base. He was in the favorite for 2010 because he stepped aside graciously. That got him that opportunity in 2010, made him the favorite. For Nicholson, does this help him for the future? Maybe, but look ahead. The next race is 2024 for U.S. Senate. Eric Hovde is a Madison businessman who's making noise about running. He didn't run for governor this past year, talked about running for U.S. Senate. If Nicholson were to get in for a Senate and Hovde is there, you have the same problem that Nicholson had this race, right? A wealthy business guy, you can write a check that you can't. But he's only in his early 40s. Down the road, maybe this pays off and he can run again. I mean, 10 years from now, he could run again and still be okay, age-wise for office. Now, the shots. They're not haymakers. The gloves aren't really off. Maybe we've gone from our gloves to our wraps, all right? How about that? It's not a personal dig. She didn't really go after his family or him personally or an ethical. Nothing like that. It's kind of this gas tax thing. So I'm wondering is, one, do people respond to it? Two, does she get any blowback for it? Because when you go negative as a candidate, sometimes you get a little bit of I'm not quite happy with that from the base. Three, the pack supporting her is also up in the air. $1.2 million to the primary with a gas tax ad. They see this as something they can hit Michaels on because the base is not like tax increases, right? Oh, by the way, if Michaels wins the nomination, it makes it hard for Republicans to prosecute a gas tax question against Evers, right? Because they want to talk about Evers proposed raising the gas tax and indexing it while also repealing minimum markup on gas to try to offset some of that increase. They want to make that case with high gas prices this November. If Michaels is the nominee, some people argue to me, it's harder to make that case. For Michaels, how does he respond? Does he have a glass jaw? Does the punch come and he gets wobbly? We'll see. He hasn't been doing a lot of media interviews.
Right, and we haven't seen him in a debate yet.
Nope, talk radio a little bit, but not no gaggles that I've been to with him. How does he respond to that? That's a big question going out there. It is a two-person race at this point. But where is it at? I'm not quite sure. And I'm fascinated to see how these attacks land on Michaels if he responds appropriately or if he gets kind of knocked off his game a little bit.
And you always have to throw the question out there, where do Nicholson supporters go? Of course, Nicholson made big headlines because he was a part of that I want the no endorsement option at the state convention. Well, it worked. There was an endorsement. They did pass a resolution to have that option on delegates' ballots. So there was, when we were watching from the crowd, it seemed like a lot of people were for that movement. But where do they go now? If they weren't even attached to Nicholson, but just liked his concept, it remains to be seen. Also important to note some endorsements this week. former governor Tommy Thompson endorsed Tim Michaels this morning. And then within minutes, Rebecca Clavish sent out a statement saying, well, I have the backing of 50-plus state representatives in the Capitol.
It's kind of like she heard the rumors we did that Tommy endorsement was coming.
Right. So she was on her toes.
One thing with the Nicholson supporters, logically, they seem to line up with Michaels, right?
Right.
Same profile. They're both business people, veterans, one was outsiders. I'm not suggesting it's going to be everybody going to Michaels.
Correct.
But talking to people this week, they feel like he's like the beneficiary of him dropping out. Charles Franklin, Marquette poll, tweeted out that those who liked Nicholson had equally favorable views of Clayfish and Michaels. But again, I think that logic tells us we probably need a little bump for Michaels in there. Just don't know where the numbers are in this race, because that primary polling is a little bit, I don't say dubious, but it's hard to get right.
Right.
Especially this far out.
And there's still some undecided voters.
Yeah,
they still don't know who they want to vote for. That will come probably maybe just walking up to poll. Some people that walk in and say, well, I'm going to go this one today.
Even though we live and breathe this stuff,
yeah.
It is mid-July.
Yeah.
People have lives,
right.
You know, unlike us.
Yeah.
They're on vacation. They're focused
they're
on that.
Thinking about this. Right?
Yes.
I had a friend the other day. Wait, who's running? You know, I mean, there's still those people out there. Another big story this week. You know, take it as you is, Jared, when I explain this. But basically, Nashville, of course, is in the running with Milwaukee to host the Republican National Convention in 2024. They did not pass a framework agreement, basically, that showcases, yes, we have the ability for security, hotels, closed down streets to host this big political event. Well, they withdrew that. So there was no vote on it this week. They still have time to do that. But it does send a strong signal to the National Party that there's a lot of people that really don't want this convention to come to their town. Of course, it's a red state in a tiny, you know, Nashville itself, the city is very blue. I talked to some Metro Council members from Nashville this week saying, you know, that the support is just not there. We don't want to, at this time, basically noting January 6th, they think there could be a potential, you know, acts of violence if this convention comes. Those were some of the concerns. But this kind of gives Milwaukee a little bit of an edge over Nashville, because they already passed a similar framework agreement in June. So they might be the only contender, but this by no means means Nashville is out of the running. We did ask Representative Knodel at a press conference earlier this week. He's a Republican from the suburbs of Milwaukee. Just asked him, you know, what do you think about the excitement that this is a possibility now? Let's take a listen.
It's terrific that we have an entity willing to bring this convention and all the business that comes with it to our state. And to our city, Milwaukee touts itself as the engine of Wisconsin. So they certainly should be reaching out and trying to gain these type of events. And so I applaud the leaders of Milwaukee for doing that, for making this effort. And I hope we land it, and I hope those dollars flow into the Wisconsin economy. And after it's all over, I hope we elect Republicans to office.
So the latest that I've heard is RNC officials are going to make an announcement in August. Nashville has until about the first week of August to pass this framework. Mm-hmm. So it's really going to come down to the wire, and we'll wait and see, I guess.
Don't forget, Milwaukee also had a little hemming and hawing about passing
Very
this
true.
Framework because of similar concerns. So there might be some other factors in play for the RNC, like where the Dems going to go. You know, if they're like right next door to each other, it's kind of a different optic. So I don't think Nashville's out of it, but yes, it is another kind of like a there's some people don't want it there.
All right. Also this week, State Senator Kathy Bernier is threatening to sue the Secretary of State, Doug La Follette. She's basically saying that he is not sending paperwork that is required for him to do in related to the amending the U.S. Constitution. Basically, this paperwork, these documents have been sitting on La Follette's desk since March when they landed there on March 22nd, I believe. And she's basically saying, hey, you got to send this in. You got to do your job. I gave you a list of all the names and addresses. Why haven't you done it? La Follette's basically arguing when I talked to him yesterday saying, hey, I don't have enough resources. I'm really short-staffed. He was working from home yesterday. He was just on a months-long trip to Africa. So, you know, it is a political season. Mm-hmm. He is running. He has a Democratic opponent, three Republicans also looking to unseat him. But really at issue is this joint resolution that lawmakers passed in January that basically signals support for a convention to amend the U.S. Constitution related to federal spending. And in order for that to occur, 34 state legislatures need to do this. So this this resolution won't have any specific impact on voters. It's more of a processing, you know, thing that the state Secretary of State's office has to do. So let's first take a listen to Senator Vernier about her possibly seeking legal action if LaFollette doesn't do this, and we'll dive into it.
Doug LaFollette, I think because of his name, has like coasted under the radar for most people. You know, name recognition is a big deal when you're elected. I like to think that I have great name recognition, and if I ran again, I'd be elected and some people would vote for me because they know the name. But the fact of the matter is they have been uninformed about this man who does not show up for work. That his duties, statutory responsibilities, his office is to be open for full and free access by the public at any time to come in and inspect documents. His office is not open most of the time. He's not in his office most of the time. He's got until August 1st to get his job done, and then we'll start legal action against him.
Vernier is giving a hard deadline of August 1st for LaFollette to do this. When I asked LaFollette, do you think he can get it done? He said, well, yeah, of course. This is now a priority. He also said it's something that he hasn't had to do before. It's a unique resolution that has to be sent to, I believe, over 100 people, some members of Congress, some other state legislatures, et cetera. So remains to be seen. But Kathy even told me, Senator Vernier, also, you know, if even Doug LaFollette gets this done, he wins re-election. And she has a little bit of a window. She also wants to possibly find ways to remove him from office because her and many other Republicans are just frustrated with how he's been handling this office over the last, handful of years.
Oh, it's just first elected in 1974.
Yes.
One thing you remember about this whole process, I mean, the Constitution, with the 34 states needed, we're not like at 33. We're not the final one. This is not going to change that process. We're not going to get to an amendment of the Constitution. But, you know, the question for LaFollette has been, how is he functioning in this office, right? And it's an issue for Democrats and Republicans because Democrats feel like there's a statewide office which gives you a platform to talk about election issues. And he's not using it in a way that would benefit Democrats or raise issues Democrats care about. You know, Doug has no influence over elections whatsoever. They took those powers away years and years and years ago from the Secretary of State's office. But still, you can be an advocate. Sarah Galuski, for example, there aren't many responsible to the Treasurer's office anymore. But she's used that office over the last 3.5 years as a platform for various things, not just to launch a bid for U.S. Senate, but talk about issues that Democrats care about. Democrats be like, why aren't you doing the same thing in that office?
Right. All right. Well, we'll see what happens by August 1st. Stock picks this week, rising. I always butcher this.
Mike Hipsch.
That's it. Mike Hipsch,
former Assembly Speaker, former DOA Secretary, and a former member of the Public Service Commission. The Supreme Court, in yet another 4-3 ruling this week, rejected efforts to try and subpoena Hipsch's communications about a approval by the PSC of a high voltage transmission line. So, take a big picture look here. This transmission line is from Dubuque to Middleton. It's like $400 or $500 million. Hipsch was one of three people on the commission, all voted for the line. Opponents tried to disqualify Hipsch and the chair of the commission for various reasons, arguing conflicts. They went then to circuit court to challenge the approval of this line. Now, normally, in a challenge of a PSC decision, the circuit court can only use a record before it, i.e. what the commission gathered for evidence. The opponents wanted to expand that record to Hipsch's personal communications, including a smartphone, arguing there are all kinds of like things that they think look unseemly. For example, more than 200 calls with a lobbyist for one of the companies involved. After Hipsch left the PSC, the job opened up with one of the utilities involved in the line. He applied for the CEO's job. Now, he didn't get it. Also didn't even get an interview for the job, but they said, hey, these things look inappropriate. They look like a conflict of interest. We want to explore this option. And the court said you're not going to do a fishing expedition. You did not raise enough of provide any evidence, really, to justify going through this guy's phone to get him to these court records, all these kinds of things. You did not hit that bar. There is we afford decision makers an assumption of honesty, essentially, in these cases, and you are not getting close to that line. The opponents say, look, these things look unseemly. Unless we get these records, we can't prove they're unseemly. You're shutting off the avenue to prove this is wrong. The big picture is this is a sigh of relief for all kinds of decision makers and judges. So don't kid yourself. The justices knew there's personal stake in this. Brian Hagedorn actually raised this during oral arguments of, okay, I have, I think it was a fantasy football league with one of my former law clerks. We communicate about that. If somebody's unhappy with my decision in a court case, could they then subpoena my records, because that guy's appeared before the court, could they subpoena our communications? Like, this is a very dangerous precedent to set. And the minority in this case says, look, what you guys have done, because procedure, I'm a dork about court stuff, but there's a procedure here to get this in front of the court. They said you went, it's a procedural anomaly. And what you're doing is creating this shield for people like us. You're creating haves and have-nots in the justice system. That's not right. But for regulators, they can live life without looking over their shoulder all the time of like, okay, I talked to so-and-so. Do I have to be worried that just having a casual, you know, cocktail with somebody means my life's being pried open before the prying eyes of the public about every communication I have with that person? So a big decision for not just Hipsch, but decision makers in general.
All right. And mixed this week, school spending, because Wisconsin saw the third lowest growth in the nation, which is now kind of middle in the pack.
Yes, we were 11th, I think, in 2002. Now we're down to 25th, 2020. The same time this happened, we've also dropped from top 10 for personal income, for personal share of personal income going to state and local taxes, from top 5 to like down to 20s, I think. I'm not sure that's related, but got to note that's going on. So look, what's going to be interesting about this discussion as well is going forward. Because advocates for school funding say, hey, we are starting to starve our schools of resources. This is not good. Republicans are saying, hey, we had a ton of federal money come in this last budget. That's why we kept spending flat despite having this giant budget surplus. We're going to have a ton of money, barring the bottom drop in the economy, the next budget. You'll see Democrats arguing we should make up for this. We're moving away from what we would care about, which is more money for schools. Republicans are talking about new tax cuts. You're also going to see a discussion about funding kids, not systems, right? What that means is a buzzword now in this choice community of we should give each kid a voucher, essentially, and say, you can go to any school you want to, private or public, here's your money, you take it where you want to. That makes schools compete in their minds for resources. Others are saying, ooh, that's a step too far for us. We're doing choice, we got choice program, we've got voucher. Let's not open the doors to everybody going at this. That's going to be an interesting debate. If there's a Republican in the governor's office next January. If there's no Republican governor, that's going nowhere. They may talk about it, may pass a bill, but Evers will never sign it. But watch that debate going forward in the next session if you have full control by Republicans.
And falling this week, open record advocates. This was another SCOTUS ruling about attorneys.
Another 4-3 decision. So here, oftentimes when you're open records, you're seeking a government document, you file the lawsuit after they don't turn it over, and then they say, oh, we're going to give you the record. Previously, courts had said, especially the appeals courts, okay, you forced that release by filing the lawsuit. Ergo, you're entitled to attorney's fees. The court has set a standard now of no. You must have some kind of court action before you get attorney's fees. So if I sue you, Emily, for records, and you delay for a year, and I've gone to court, I filed a lawsuit, we're going through depositions, and right on the eve of trial, you give me the records, I can't get
anything.
No. We think. Now, here's the caveat. This court loves to hear itself right, as I've said before. If you watch all these court decisions this week, if Rebecca Bradley wrote the majority opinion, Brian Hagedorn wrote a concurring one that got to the same place, but for different reasons sometimes. If Brian Hagedorn wrote the majority opinion, Rebecca Bradley wrote a concurring opinion. Got to the same place, but different on how to get there sometimes. In this one, the conservative majority said, you can't get them, period. Brian kind of went, well, there may be some options. So he left the door open a little bit. For example, the example I just gave. If you delay for a long time, unnecessary delay, could you then get fees? We don't know for sure. The court hasn't answered that question. But we do know is before, especially the appeals court have said, okay, you guys, you know, sued here, you got the record returned over, we're going to allow you to get attorney's fees. That can't happen anymore. You have to have some kind of court action going forward, we think. This was a case out of Waukesha where there was a local government trying to bring in an amateur baseball team, college kids playing amateur baseball in the summer. They wanted to get the contract. They filed open records request for documents related to this effort. They asked for the contract. Contract was not turned over. The day before the council met about this issue, they filed a lawsuit. The day after the council met, they gave them the contract. So they released it and said, okay, you're entitled to court fees because they delayed. They improperly denied you the contract in the first place. They delayed it, so therefore you get them. They said, no, you can't. So for open records advocates, this raises the bar, these lawsuits, because they're expensive.
Right, they're not cheap.
And if they go on for months on end, you may not get anything in the end, even though you've pushed a government entity to turn those records.
All right. Jam-packed week with Supreme Court rulings, and I think we got almost all of them in. Not all, but we got the big ones taken care of for you. So that will be it. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.